This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. Scott Simon is away. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
The government and people of Israel welcome the opportunity to renew direct negotiations.
This is an important moment. A new opportunity for peace exists.
We believe that with hard work and good faith and courage, it is possible to bring peace to the Middle East.
That was Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas speaking through an interpreter, and President George Bush. The three met this week in Aqaba, Jordan, to discuss the Bush administration's roadmap for Middle East peace. The summit, to end 32 months of violence, capped a week-long overseas trip that brought Mr. Bush from Krakow to Qatar. NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore joins us to discuss that journey and the rest of the week's news. Dan?
Hi, Linda. Glad to see you.
On Wednesday, the president met in Jordan with Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas. The three seem to emerge optimistic. Are they still smiling?
Maybe a little bit less. The roadmap has already struck its first snag. The leaders of the militant Hamas have broken off the ceasefire talks they were holding with Prime Minister Abbas, saying that he hadn't won enough concessions for the Palestinians, that he had done wrong by referring to the suffering of the Jewish people over the ages. And now they are demanding that Abbas denounce that speech that he made in Aqaba, speech which, by the way, was drafted with the help of the Bush administration. Whether this is on the part of Hamas simply a negotiating tactic or whether it's part of some final rejection is too early to say, but it does take a little bit off of the bloom off the rose of Aqaba.
What do you see as the roadblocks that are facing the two prime ministers?
Well, essentially each one has to deal with his own extremists behind him who are opposing what they're trying to do. The roadblock of Hamas, we've already seen, may be joined by other rejectionist groups like Islamic Jihad. They've been holding rallies against the peace effort yesterday. Prime Minister Sharon faces his extremists, ultra-religious groups who are unwilling to dismantle settlements or even the so-called outposts that Sharon talks about. It's what happens when you try to bring two parties together that have been against each other all this time, and that is you can get at the center two people who reach agreement, but at the edges of each you get the rejection.
And where do you think Palestinian President Yasser Arafat is in all of this?
Where Arafat generally is, sowing confusion, demanding attention. The other day he gave an interview to the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv saying that he would not stand in the way of Abbas and his peace effort. Yesterday he attended an executive committee meeting of the Palestine Authority, and he already has been criticizing Abbas, saying that Israel is planning new and more acts of aggression after the summit. Arafat, unfortunately for this effort, commands most of the security organizations, and he is in a position to make trouble, and undoubtedly will.
Elsewhere in the region, Dan, have other Arab leaders reacted well to the roadmap?
Well, they were faced with a President Bush whose prestige in that region has increased a lot since the successful war, the invasion of Iraq. And the Arab states are now, except for Syria possibly, are now willing to support the idea of the roadmap. They decided it's in their interest to back the Bush initiative. However, I think in the end, what will decide whether this works or doesn't work is going to be President Bush himself, and whether he is willing to involve himself personally in something in which he now has invested a great deal of his prestige. He's now named the National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of State Powell as his surrogates there. They set up a monitoring group with John Wolf at the head of it. But in the end, I'm afraid President Bush, if he wants to make this work, is going to have to stick with this personally and over a protracted period of time if this is to work.
At the end of his trip, the president made a triumphal flight over Baghdad. He visited troops in the region. But at home, there are skeptics suggesting that intelligence leading up to the war was skewed by the Bush administration to make the Iraqi threat loom larger than it really was. They're pointing to major caches of banned weapons that have not been found.
Well, it is true that the justification for the invasion as given to Congress and to the country generally was preemption, that there was an imminent threat to national security that had to be met. It would be very helpful to administration to be able to show now that there was that threat. Since August, the president and other officials were stating with great certitude that Saddam Hussein was planning to use weapons of mass destruction. Tony Blair told his people that it could be done on 45 minutes' notice. The failure so far to show any solid evidence of that is beginning to loom as a fairly major embarrassment, at least to President Bush, and certainly to Tony Blair, who's been accused from the floor of the House of Commons of having lied.
What about life in the streets of Iraq? Do you think the reconstruction effort seems to be getting on track?
Well, it's getting on track, but rather more slowly than they would like to get on track. The dilemma with Iraq is the United States invaded Iraq saying that it was going to spread democracy to Iraq. And now they are telling, because of the trouble they're having getting power started, getting the country running again, they're saying, we're here to give you democracy, but we'll tell you when democracy starts. And that becomes also a little bit of an embarrassment. When there's enough security on the streets, when the water or power are all working, sufficiently repaired. And until that time, the Iraqis are getting to feel, well, where is that democracy? Where is the freedom that they were been promised? And then there is the problem that there is a pervasive sense of insecurity with American soldiers being killed about one every day or so. So this is a difficult time in trying to bring Iraq into the civilized community, because it was very hard to say we're going to spread democracy, but not yet.
Well, let's talk about what's going on in the American democracy. Here in Washington, the Senate voted 94-2 on Thursday to include the working poor in the recent child tax credit increase. There's still some tough opposition to that in the House. How come?
Well, it's not how come there's so much opposition, but how come the opposition is dying. In the final House-Senate conference, they found themselves with needing to cut out another $3.5 billion to stay within the ceiling of $350 billion that the Senate had passed. As that, without telling anybody very much, they found they could save $3.5 billion if they deprived the working poor of an added $400 on top of $600 in tax credit. And they tried to get away with that, and all of a sudden it exploded in their face. New York Times carried a big story about it, others carried stories about it, and people around the country began saying, why do you have to do this at the expense of the most deserving working poor? And so the Senate did a complete turnaround and got this overwhelming vote, and Tom DeLay in the House, who had said he wouldn't even let it come up on the floor, is also beginning to change his mind. It's sort of, for once, popular opinion expresses itself and has an effect.
Howell Raines, the executive editor of the New York Times, and Gerald Boyd, the paper's managing editor, resigned on Thursday, casualties of the Jason Blair scandal. Dan, how does that strike you?
Well, the way it strikes me is this way. The Jason Blair scandal simply opened up a systemic problem in the New York Times that they were not getting along with their editor. And he tried to make amends afterwards, did not succeed. And so in the end, he had to resign, which meant, in effect, that Howell Raines was fired by his staff.
Dan, thank you.
Yep.
NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore.